Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to this show David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he is here and talks a little bit about financial planning. And he begins by making some comments, and sometimes it's about the economy, sometimes it's about some sort of investment topic, and usually it involves one of the or both of those things, really. So have a few things to say as we get started, and then if you have questions about that or anything else that has to do with financial planning and money management, I know he will do his best to help you out. And with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here once again.
Well, good morning, David, and as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to begin this morning by recapping the 2006 performance of the U.S. and world stock markets. And then we'll take a final look at our couch potato portfolio's performance in 2006. And then I'll cover a few miscellaneous financial matters as we head into 2007 and watch it unfold. Of course, it's no secret that both U.S. and international stock markets, of course, enjoyed a very, very good year. In fact, the European stock indexes really led the way, with total returns of approximate 33%. Emerging markets gained more than 28% for the year, and even the Pacific Rim, which is primarily comprised of Japanese stocks, gained some 12% for the year. Now, the total international index, which is 20% of our couch potato portfolio, gained almost 27% for the year. Now, while 2006 was the year of the international investor, U.S. stocks also enjoyed a very, very good year as well. For example, our benchmark S&P 500 gained almost 16% for the year. Now, that's including dividends, of course. And if an investor simply purchased the entire U.S. stock market on a market capitalized basis, returns would have also approached about 16%. Now, an example of the entire market is the Wilshire 5000, or, for example, at Vanguard, the Total Market Index. Interestingly enough, but not surprising, investors were far better off in 2006 by investing in indexes rather than actively managed stock mutual funds. On average, these stock mutual funds underperformed their benchmark indexes by about 3% for the year. And while 3% doesn't sound like a lot, it's a huge number over long periods of time. Also, it's difficult not to mention the continued performance of the REIT sector of the U.S. markets. REITs, R-E-I-T-S, of course, are real estate corporations, which are in the business of owning, buying, and selling commercial properties. The Vanguard REIT Index, for example, which is 10% of our couch potato portfolio, imagine this, gained 35% for the year. And unbelievably enough, over the past 5 years, this index has compounded at more than 22%. This is just a remarkable performance. And through yesterday's close, despite a very tough residential real estate market and a very choppy beginning to stocks in 2007, our REIT index has, well, it surged ahead almost 4%. For bond investors, it's really a much different story. Most bond investors' total return for 2006 ranged in the areas of 2.5% to approximately 4.5%, depending upon the average maturity and duration of the bonds held. In fact, fixed income investors in 2006 were frankly better off in money market funds and certificates of deposit, where returns approximated 5% on an annualized basis. Also, please keep in mind that we are in a very unusual period depicted by the fact that short-term interest rates are actually higher than long-term interest rates. This is called an inverted yield curve. Normally, we expect to receive higher rates of return if we tie up our money for longer periods of time. But today, one-year rates approximate 5%, five-year rates approximate 4.8%, and 10-year rates, if you tie your money up that long, well, you would earn about 4.6% if you held your instrument to maturity. Historically, inverted yield curves have been followed by recession. So we'll have to stay tuned on that one and see how 2007 unfolds. Now that we have briefly discussed stocks and bonds, I should point out that our couch potato portfolio in 2006, if we were invested from January 1 through December 31, that portfolio gained 22.4% for the year. I hope that made some listeners happy. Frankly, it made my wife happy, so that's maybe even more important than the listeners at WILL. But in any event, 22.4% was the return for the year. Thus far in 2007, well, we're sort of treading water, so to speak. Our portfolio is pretty choppy, but it's still up very, very slightly for the year, 0.2%. Now, I received a very interesting email asking me how to allocate our various couch potato index funds between taxable accounts and retirement accounts. Let me see if I can give you an example. Suppose we had retirement accounts of, well, $50,000, and then we had after-tax money of $50,000, and we decided to purchase our 8 different indexes in our couch potato portfolio. The question is, well, which indexes should be purchased in the tax-deferred retirement accounts, and which indexes should be purchased in the after-tax accounts? The answer is really based upon what is called portfolio turnover during the year. The less portfolio turnover a fund experiences, the less tax impact for the individual investor. Now, portfolio turnover really means what percent of the portfolio, what percent of the assets in the fund is sold during the year. From a tax standpoint, less is better. Less portfolio turnover is better because it doesn't generate gains or taxable events. In other words, the funds with the highest portfolio turnover should be placed in the retirement or tax-deferred accounts. And in our couch potato portfolio, the indexes with the highest portfolio turnover rate are essentially the emerging markets index. It's highly volatile. Lots of stocks get bought and sold. Interestingly enough, next is U.S. small cap value, then U.S. large value, followed by the mid cap index. So if I were allocating the various funds between taxable accounts and non-taxable accounts, the 4 that I just mentioned would be in the retirement or tax-deferred accounts. So those would be indeed my choices. Finally, let's talk 2007 economics just for a moment. And there continues to be what I would call decent news. It's not extraordinarily optimistic, but it certainly is not pessimistic. Most interesting, the manufacturing sector of our economy increased its production of goods by 0.4% in December. That's important because the previous 3 months, that sector had negative growth. It actually contracted. Wholesale inflation continues to be pretty tame. For all of 2006, wholesale prices rose somewhere between 1 and 2%, depending upon whom you believed and what statistics you believed. And obviously, a barrel of oil has dropped dramatically to the low $50 range, especially over the last 30 days. And gasoline is finally dropping in price, although most analysts agree that gasoline should be 20 or 30 cents a gallon cheaper today than it is relative to the drop in oil prices. At the moment, the Federal Reserve is still sitting on interest rates with no real suggestion, certainly, that they are going to raise interest rates. I think that's good news for corporations because higher interest rates obviously detract from profitability. It compresses profitability. It has an impact on dividends paid to shareholders. So that's pretty good news. Now, of course, the housing industry, at least the residential housing industry, is certainly depressed, but it's certainly a very good time for buyers and, of course, a tougher time for sellers, especially in certain major metropolitan markets of the country like Boston, San Diego, and LA, to name just a few. Those are really the major markets that have really suffered lower housing costs. Houses have dropped, condos have dropped some 10, 15, in some cases, even far more. There was a recent article about Naples, Florida in the Wall Street Journal just about 10 days ago. showing where people had gone in and speculated. About 50% of that housing market had been by speculators, by purchasers of second homes, and especially in the range of homes between $250,000 and $500,000. That mid-tier market has really fallen out of bed. People who paid $400,000 or $500,000 for properties are now finding out their properties are worth $250,000 and $300,000, drops of 40 and even 50%. That would be pretty tough to take. So overall, pretty decent economic news moving into 2007. Stock market, although a choppy start, there's really no reason to think at the moment that it's going to drop precipitously. So we'll have to wait and continue to observe the economic news. So there you have it, David. I'd be delighted to answer questions on these issues I've raised or tackle questions from our listeners, I guess, so long as my voice lasts, and we'll be in good shape. And of course, I want to wish everybody a very happy new year and a very prosperous 2007.
Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month he's here. We talk about money management strategies. And if you have a financial planning question, give us a call. And I know Dave will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here who is ready to go. Someone in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. I guess we're on the same track because I'm sitting here taking notes like crazy, but the lecture was a little faster than I anticipated. What I'm interested in, quickly, and I got some of the percentages, is based on the couch potato.
Yes.
For 2006. So with the index 500 was 16%. Is that right?
Pretty close, inclusive of dividends.
Oh, okay. And then what happens without dividends? Where would it put it?
Well, it's going to drop at about 1.8%. In other words, when you buy the S&P 500, every dollar that you put in that S&P 500, you're expecting dividends from all of those companies of about 1.8%.
Oh, okay. That's great.
So you make a penny and eight tenths on your dollar.
Now, what happens with what about the next one down, the U.S. value?
Well, U.S. large value, I'm looking it up if I've got it in front of me. The large value return was just a bit more than the S&P 500, as I recall. And again, dividends pretty similar.
Okay. And then what about the small cap?
Small cap was almost the same as the S&P 500.
Oh, wow.
Yep. The real difference makers, of course, were the international positions as well as the REIT index.
Now, the small index, that was about the same, too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were pretty much the same. Large was just a little bit higher than small this year.
Okay.
Large outperformed small. Most of the commentators thought it was going to be a big difference, but frankly, it was a percent or two, not very, very much. But again, the international sector really made a huge difference this year. Emerging markets made a gigantic difference. And then the REIT index continued to make a very, very large difference.
I did get that. That was 37% and then 27% for the international. Is that right?
Yeah. Just amazing numbers, aren't they?
Yeah. It's a little scary.
Well, they certainly are scary because we know that ultimately things revert to their mean rates of return.
Right.
And these are way, way over mean rates of return. Does that mean that we should abandon our positions? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's still a question of are you allocated properly across these asset classes? And at the same time, do you have sufficient fixed income for emergencies or income so that you can draw on it in times where you don't want to draw on stocks in case stocks are moving negative?
Mm-hmm.
The worst possible case is where you're pulling money out of stocks and stocks are going down. You want to have sufficient fixed income.
Now, the emerging market, I took that for, that was 28%, was that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And 33% was what?
33% was actually the European stock index.
Wow.
And we utilize in our couch potato really the total international index.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And the total international index consists of approximately 70%, 60 to 70% European, about 20% Pacific Rim, 20 to 25, and about 10% emerging markets.
Yeah, well, you're doing a great job. So thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, but indexes are going to do what they're going to do. The bigger issue is, are we properly allocated?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks.
My pleasure.
Let's go to a caller on our line four, someone on a cell phone. Hello.
Good morning. Yes. On a cell phone here in Chicago, so I hope I don't lose the connection. I've invested in the domestic REIT funds quite a few years ago, and as you mentioned, made quite well on it. And I also invested in the international REIT funds. I now notice that quite a few other fund families are opening up the international REIT funds, specifically Ing and Fidelity. And I was wondering, what's your view on that, seeing that maybe the REIT boom we've had here will now start moving overseas?
Well, everyone likes to copy a hot asset class. That's number one. And number two, if I were going to be investing in international REITs, since I'm already have about a 10% position in REITs, I would probably, if I'm going to dabble in international REITs, I would take my U.S. position, move that to 7, and I would go international with 3. But the jury's really out on that, and I want to be real careful, because one of the things that has been well controlled in the U.S. REIT funds has been expenses. And I'm not clear, I haven't seen that yet in international REITs, what kind of expenses we're going to have to run these international REITs. I think it's going to be significantly higher than running U.S. REITs. So I dabble, be careful, to the extent that you add to international REITs, decrease your U.S.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to someone here next in Urbana, the caller's line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I was wanting to find out. I have investments in TIAA, CREF, and I read an article that said that growth funds have not performed well, which I've proved over the past couple of years, but that they expected that this would be a turnaround time for them. And I was wondering about your thoughts on that, particularly in light of your comments on the inverted yield curve.
Well, first of all, I think TIAA CREF is an amazing organization. They are excellent money managers. They have an excellent track record. They are very, very high quality. Having said that, I think there are choices within the CREF menu that are better than other choices. CREF actually has a CREF stock fund, which is basically the Russell 3000, which has just performed magnificently for a number of years. It's basically an index, and that's my favorite in the CREF sector of choices. So CREF has good choices, but that's the best one in my view, and to the extent that you are going to place money in CREF, I think you can't go wrong with CREF stock or the CREF Russell 3000 fund. Some of the other growth funds, well, they're sort of like other people's growth funds, neither better nor worse, but it is true that when you introduce active management, especially in 2006, now you've got a manager trying to outperform a benchmark. And all of the academic studies that I've looked at, that over long, long periods of time, it's very, very difficult for the manager to outperform the benchmark because the manager has got so many expenses and portfolio turnover to deal with, and marketing costs and 12b-1 costs. So all of these things add up, and they detract from an investor's return. So it's not that growth funds aren't good. It's just that it's very, very tough over long periods of time for growth funds to outperform indexes. And again, I've said this on other programs, I'm just not smart enough to figure out which manager is going to outperform the benchmarks over long periods of time. And if you look at 20-year time horizons, about 90% of growth fund managers are not going to outperform their benchmark over long periods of time. You're going to find a hot manager in a short period of time outperforming their benchmark. Yes, I mean, just pure blind luck would suggest that there are going to be many managers in the short run. But as soon as we start taking that long-term view, it's much tougher over long periods to figure out who is that manager that's going to consistently outperform the benchmark. And it's about 10% of the managers, but you got to figure out who they are, and that takes tremendous study, analysis, and probably some luck. And frankly, I don't want to spend that time. I like to go fishing, spend time with my family, so that's one of the reasons I index.
Okay. So in other words, you wouldn't really look real positively on that growth fund compared to other parts of craft.
Right. I think it's a great fund. Don't misunderstand me. It's just that there are better funds.
Right.
So you want to look at the funds that are indexed to the market. And Craft has several, and those are the ones that I would specialize in and utilize for my portfolio.
Okay, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Right.
And again, another caller here in Des Plaines up in the Chicago area, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. David, I have a question for you in the real estate area. And the question is in connection with a summer home. Do you have a general opinion and more specifically for my interest in northwestern Michigan?
You know, I have to tell you that I'm not that familiar with that area. Have you already purchased the home?
No.
Oh, so you're looking.
Yes.
You're looking. Northwestern Michigan, tell me the area you're looking in.
Oh, on Charlevoix. And
yeah, expensive areas.
Yeah.
Yeah, expensive areas. I must confess, I really don't have a lot of knowledge, but I'm guessing that prices are lower than they were a year or two ago. Is that what you're finding? Have you analyzed the area?
I've seen some deterioration, yeah.
Yeah, and I think if I was going to be a buyer of a second home, I would have no problem in placing lowball offers on properties that I was interested in. And I want to find a realtor who is not embarrassed to take me on and say, hey, this property is listed at $400,000, $300,000. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in buying this property at 20 or 25% below its listing.
Oh.
That's the kind of realtor I want to find.
Mm-hmm.
And I want a realtor who is willing to present those kinds of offers, maybe 5, 6, 10 different places, until a seller says, you know, I can't take the pain any longer. I need to sell this property, and you as a buyer will get a good purchase.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So I think you want to find the right realtor to work with.
A buyer representative?
Well, I don't think it matters whether it's a buyer representative or a standard traditional realtor. I think you want to find someone who is willing to go in there and not be embarrassed. Many realtors will not. They simply will not present offers that they feel are embarrassingly low.
I see.
All right? I think that's the factor. And obviously you want someone who really knows the business and knows the area.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Bye. Our guest this morning is David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. And he talks about money management and investment strategies. Personal finance questions are welcome. Obviously, this is something where we want you to think very carefully before you make decisions. Do your research. Ask as many questions as you can. Get different opinions. This is one place you can add to your store of knowledge, and I know that Dave will do his best to help you out and answer your questions, give you some things to think about. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Houston, Texas, believe it or not, here we have a caller on line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I just have a question. What do you think about housing market in D.C. area in this coming summer? Because I have a property over there. I want to sell it in this summer.
I think you should hold. That's my opinion. I think it's one of the markets where you're going to have some impact and deterioration of value. Have you been following that market carefully?
I haven't. I rent it now, but, you know, I had to, but the rent is not enough to pay my mortgage, so I'm thinking maybe better to sell it this summer.
Is it a house? Is it a condo? Is it a townhouse?
It's a townhouse.
Townhouse? Where is it located?
It's in Frederick.
Mm.
It's
well,
about 40 miles away from D.C.
Yeah, it's certainly a wonderful location.
It is.
Yeah, there's no question about that. But clearly, prices ran up so fast over the last 3 years
mm-hmm.
that you are going to probably have difficulty realizing the price that you probably paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think what really counts here is finding the right realtor, the right real estate firm who understands how to market your property.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between realtors, real estate firms. So you want someone who specializes in your market
mm-hmm.
very, very clearly. And then you want to find the realtor who can really market your property for you.
Okay.
This is very important. This is your research on this is going to determine what kind of price you're going to end up with for this property.
Right. You're talking about hold it. So how long do you think it'd be good to hold it?
How long have you owned it?
Another year. Oh, I own it about a couple of years.
Yeah, it's very, very tough to come out on a property where you've simply owned it for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Good real estate, and you are in a good location, is sort of like fine wine. It ages, and it gets better with age. That's just the bottom line of it. Mm-hmm. So to come out and pay real estate commissions at both ends because you really paid one going in when you bought it, even though the seller claims they paid it, and then you're going to pay a real estate commission coming out, very, very tough to come out. But again, if you're being hemorrhaged and you have lots and lots of negative cash flow, you know, that's a box also. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm really not in a position without understanding more about your situation to really advise you. But the future of the real estate market, very, very tough to tell you what's going to happen in any particular metropolitan market at this point in time. But it seems as though many of these markets have sort of leveled off. You know, that's what it appears to be mm-hmm. at the moment. It's not to say that the markets won't go lower. And again, that's why you need expertise in the area where this house is located. Because I don't have a crystal ball, none of us do.
Right.
So I want to wish you good luck. And your real job is to locate the real estate firm and the realtor who can properly market your property if indeed you decide to sell it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have a couple of callers here on calling on cell phones. First is line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. My wife and I are considering whether we should roll our individual retirement accounts under one umbrella with them. We've been talking to a financial planner, and I just kind of wondered, he was talking about to do this, it would be about a 4%, I believe, charge to roll all the different retirement accounts with them. And I just wondered, does that seem pretty fair?
No. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. In other words, you have individual retirement accounts currently?
Well, we have, like, for example, my wife had one from the University of Missouri and one at the U of I. And
okay.
I one from
so those are 403B accounts, basically,
okay.
or tax-sheltered annuity accounts. Now, are there any penalties moving out of those accounts?
We'd have to check into that.
Okay. My guess is there are not. My guess is there are not. And you could certainly roll those accounts into your own self-directed IRA program.
Okay.
At any of the major mutual fund companies, for example, Vanguard, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, your choice. That is a tax-deferred rollover. And you could then invest your money in essentially no-load mutual funds. No-load funds. So I can't imagine paying 4% unless there are penalties moving out of the assets that you currently have. But to move into assets and pay a 4% front-end load with a financial planner, I can't in any sense of my imagination recommend that. Just can't recommend it.
Okay. Is that pretty typical, though?
No, it is not. What most financial planners do is that they will roll your money, and if they are truly fee financial planners or asset managers, once the money is rolled, they will charge you an annualized fee to manage the money. It sounds to me as though that you would be moving your money into what are called front-end loaded mutual funds that maybe have a 3 or 4% front-end load, which is basically the commission that would be going to the financial planner. I can't recommend that.
Okay. All right, great. That's what we wanted to know.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Another cell phone person here. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. You, a moment ago, were discussing index fund with Kraft. I have my university retirement funds in Fidelity. Is there a similar index fund that you like that Fidelity has?
Well, Fidelity has the S&P 500. Very, very competitive. I think the annualized fee on that fund is 10 to 12 basis points. It's right there with Vanguard. They go head-to-head as they are the two largest providers of the S&P 500 index for what we call retail customers. If you have millions and millions and millions of dollars that you want to index, you can go to people like Wells Fargo, et cetera. But it's very, very competitive. So that's one. They have an extended market index, which takes into consideration not only the S&P 500, but the mid-caps. I like that fund a great deal. And they also have some small cap. They're not quite indexes, but they act fairly like indexes. So Fidelity has some great choices as well. And you can call them up by going to the Fidelity menu and look under large cap, then small cap, et cetera, and they'll pop up.
Well, thank you very much. You're always helpful.
All right.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Next is someone in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello, Dave. Quick question. Ethanol plants are just popping up all over the Midwest, as I'm sure you know. And they're supposed to be a tremendous investment, and I just wondered, long-term, I'm concerned about it. I just wondered what your thoughts are on investing in new ethanol plants.
I really don't have an opinion. That's a great question. I've only seen one offering memorandum for private investors. These are usually set up as LLCs or corporations, et cetera. Have you looked at some offering memorandums?
Just briefly, yes, right. I'm concerned about the thought is that you don't get the mileage with ethanol. So much competition, and with crude oil prices dropping, I don't know whether that's continued to go down. Or,
well, I guess I'd rather be the farmer with the corn on the ground, because as there are more ethanol plants being built, we both, I think, will agree that there is tremendous upward pressure on these corn prices.
Yes.
So if you're a farmer in the field, this is a very, very good time, I think, to be in that business.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I'm just concerned about as an investment.
I really don't have an opinion. I don't have that expertise. But I will. One thing you said that I think was very interesting is there's been a lot of studies that have been done that suggest that you don't get the gas mileage with ethanol.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, there is a gentleman in the College of ACES at the University of Illinois, Professor Stephen Eckhoff, and I asked him about that very question. Stephen is really an expert in all kinds of corn and hybrid products, et cetera. Very, very well thought of, very, very well researched. Stephen told me that those studies are flawed, and that is really not the case. And if you were interested in following up, I'm sure that he would be delighted to visit with you about it. I really don't understand the science behind it, but to the extent that you are interested in it, I think he's an excellent source to talk to about ethanol plants in general. He has a lot of knowledge in this particular area. He understands the process, and he informed me at least last time that he thought that those studies were pretty flawed. On the other hand, with the price of oil coming down, et cetera, with the tremendous competition and all of these plants popping up, I think you're right. I think if you are going to invest, it wouldn't be very much money.
Yes. All right. All right. You said Steve.
Steve Eckhoff. And let's see. Steve, I think, spells his last name. Oh, it's Eckhoff, I believe. And he's you can reach him through the University of Illinois.
Yeah.
Very knowledgeable.
Right. Thank you, Steve.
Right. Thanks.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
One of the things that I know from having listened to you over a long time is that you're really hesitant to encourage people either to invest in individual stocks, individual companies, maybe not even in individual sectors, even if you think over time now, high tech, for example, has been very sexy. Some companies have done very well. Apple, for example, just right at the moment, they're doing
right.
Very well.
Right.
Microsoft, they've come a long way, and people might be really tempted to get into that or to energy or to pharmaceuticals or to, you know, something like
couldn't
that.
Couldn't agree with you more, David.
So how do you think? It sounds like you would still say you're taking
very,
on
very
a lot
tough.
Of risk.
No question. We have to remember that when we carve out what quantifies our return. Where do we get return on securities? About 93 to 94% of the return that we're going to earn over a lifetime in securities is asset allocation. Are we properly allocated over large sectors of the market? About 3% of our overall return during our lifetime is based upon, did we buy Apple or did we buy IBM or did we buy Ethanol Inc., right? And 2 or 3% may have something to do with when we get in and out of the market, but that's too hard to figure out. So the bottom line is stock selection, individual company selection. You better be darn expert in that area because it really doesn't have a lot to do with the overall return you earn over a lifetime. And again, to invest in one of these individual Well, they're called startups. Let's face it, it's a startup. It would have to be a very, very tiny percentage of my net worth to get me interested in doing it. And you really would need someone who really can analyze these deals, look at them, and give you some professional advice.
Well, I'm assuming that there are some of these big mutual fund companies that have many different funds have specialty funds. So if you wanted to invest in a fund that invested in high tech, I'm assuming that you can do that.
Well, you can, except the ethanol plant deals that are coming to the market are typically private deals with no liquidity. Okay. So as a result, mutual funds are loath to invest in a deal where there isn't liquidity. Remember, when you're in an index, all of those securities that they hold, that index fund could sell those at a price on last night's close, on today's close. Not so when you're going in and buying a piece or a share or a limited partnership interest or a securitized interest in an ethanol plant. That really hasn't been brought, shall we say, to the securitized market as yet on any massive scale.
I guess I'm wondering, and maybe it doesn't exist, I'm thinking, is there a mutual fund that, for example, holds Microsoft, Apple, Hewlett-Packard, Texas Instruments, that kind of a package.
Absolutely.
So if what you wanted to do was take a percentage of your money and say, I really believe in high tech, and I'm gonna be in S&P 500, and I'm going to be in growth, and I'm going to be in Russell, all that. But I'm saying, well, I want to take some money, though, because I really think that there's great potential here, and put it more specifically into that sector.
You could do it. That's part of the NASDAQ sector. You can buy what's called an exchange-traded fund, an ETF, which specializes in those particular areas. Much more volatile, but certainly it could be added as an asset class if you felt comfortable with it, with 2 to 5% of your money.
Well, that's – and I guess finally – and I will get on to those questions. So I guess my final question would be, you know, suppose you do that. If you take a look at how that – those generally perform, and then you look at your indices that are big and diversified, like the S&P 500. Does it really make very much sense? Does that perform well enough to so you can say you'd be better off just sticking it back in the S&P 500?
The truth of the matter is that it may slightly diversify your portfolio. Okay, it would act more as a diversifier, but at the end of the day, in terms of rate of return, probably wouldn't make much difference.
Yeah, all right. Other questions here. We have next someone on a cell phone. This is line 2. Hello.
Hi. I have a question with regards to EE bonds. I was bought bonds as gifts about 20 years ago, and now I wanted to use them for educational purposes, which entitles them to be tax-free. However, my parents who bought these for me have their own names on them. How can I use them for educational purposes without them actually being taxed?
Well, is your Social Security on the bonds or is your parents' Social Security on the bonds?
I believe both of them are.
Okay. And, you know, I'm not up on these rules. And the last time I talked about double E bonds, I made a mistake on the air, which I was rapidly corrected. In the old days, you could roll them over to H bonds. Obviously, the interest is taxable. I believe the rules, and again, I'm a little hesitant to say this, so maybe someone will call in and correct me, but for you to be able to use that interest tax-free, at least under the old rules, there were some income restrictions on the income of the parents, et cetera. Are you still being claimed as a dependent on your parents' return?
No, I'm not.
No, you're not. You know, I think probably rather than my misspeaking about this, I'd be delighted if you call me off the air. I can check on it for you. I just frankly don't want to say and give you wrong information over the air. Typically with the double E, you cash them in. The interest is going to be added to your income. And depending upon your marginal tax rate, that's what it's going to be. But there were some special rules for double E bonds being used for college education where if you were not at a specific income level, then that interest would not be taxable. But I can't recall those off the top of my head.
Okay. So where can I reach you at off the air?
I think if you call WILL Station afterwards, they'll give you my phone number after the program.
Okay, thank you so much.
Very good, thank you. Our guest this morning is David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois in the College of Business. Monthly on a Friday is here. We talk about money management and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Do you think the answer to that question, you could go to the Treasury Department's website and,
find that? Probably. I know we have the computer here. It would probably take 5 minutes to ferret it out.
Yeah,
you might just plug in and Google in double E-bonds for college. That might give you the answer. It won't take me 10 minutes to find it once I look it up, but I just hesitate to give wrong information over the air.
Okay, very good. Urbana is the next caller, line one. Hello.
Morning.
Mm-hmm. Hi there.
I have a quick question. Basically, I want to find out a little bit about green investing, you know, maybe in organics, you know, organic foods, stuff like that. It's kind of like the caller earlier talked about the ethanol plant stuff. I just wonder if there are books, websites, or you know, something like that that you might know of that would kind of enlighten me on stuff like that.
I don't, and I suspect that your best choice is, again, to go to the computer, do some searches. Have you done that?
Not yet, actually. I haven't.
All right. That would be my guess. Again, I would be cautious because it really is not asset class investing. What you would end up doing is what would be referred to as sector investing. And sector investing is extremely volatile. And over long periods of time, you are better off with asset class investing as opposed to sector investing.
Right.
Sector, you understand that?
I do. Part of what I was thinking, though, is as an investment, it might be more overall picture profitable for, you know, the world as opposed to myself, as opposed to, say, donating.
No question. I mean, there has to be some notion of altruism here.
Right.
And that's why a lot of people like what they refer to as socially responsible funds.
Uh-huh.
Although it's very difficult to define social responsibility, it sort of gets lost.
Yeah.
So the socially responsible funds that I've looked at, I think I could make a claim on every stock that is held that they are not necessarily socially responsible.
Right. I mean, mutual funds are
sure. So
diverse that it's hard to find anything that's that would be considered truly green.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I haven't done any research in that area. So I'll also put that on my list to take a look at that as well and report back on next month's show.
Good. Good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Next up should be someone here on cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah. Good. Thanks.
I'm calling. My husband's thinking about retiring at age 59 from his job and doing something else. He's got a defined benefit plan and Social Security benefits, and we've been trying to figure out how to figure out whether or not it's a good idea to claim your pension as soon as you can or to defer it. So we just need some advice on how to what to evaluate and how to approach that problem.
Well, one question I would have is the defined benefit integrated with Social Security?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so that means that eventually the defined benefit that you would be receiving if you took it at 59 and a half could actually go down at the time that you started accessing Social Security benefits.
Right. It's reduced by your Social Security.
Yes, that's called an integrated plan.
Okay.
I presume the defined benefit is not indexed for inflation. In other words, it always stays the same if you say that you took it and then you didn't access your Social Security.
Oh, so that would be something.
That's very important to find out. So if your pension benefit is $2,000 a month, is it indexed for inflation? Most private corporate employers do not index their DB plans for inflation. Some do, however, and it's very important to find that out because that may have an impact. Also, keep in mind that if you were thinking of drawing Social Security benefits at 62 or 63, there are some limitations based upon how much income you earn through the sweat of your brow on wages. So was it the thought of possibly retiring and starting taking a defined benefit at 59 and a half? Was that one thought?
Well, we're just kind of, it's about 2 years out, and so we're thinking, I'm not going to retire then. He's not going to stop working.
Okay. If he's interested in another position, it's entirely possible that it might make sense to take the benefit at 59 and a half. I think you have to sit down with a benefits counselor at your place of work and look at those alternatives and say, look, I'm thinking of retiring at 59 and a half. What's the difference between my taking the pension benefit immediately at 59 and a half, at 62, and 65?
Okay.
And I think that will shed a lot of light on what really makes sense for you. And it's none too early to do that. It's none too early to do that, since you're maybe 2 years out. And, of course, it sounds like your husband is going to reinvent himself. If he does retire from this position, he would be doing something else.
I hope so.
Okay. Now, if you're going to stay working, he better stay working. Hello? I'm just kidding you now. You said you're still working. You're not going to let him retire and stay at home while you're out there every day working.
Well, if he makes dinner and cleans the house.
That's the same thing.
Okay, I just wanted to hear that.
Nice dinner on the table when you come home.
All right, bottom line is that you need to talk to that retirement benefits counselor.
Okay. That's where the source of the information is.
You bet.
And then you play your hand that you're going to retire.
I don't think so. I think it's perfectly legitimate to ask, what happens if I retire at 59 and a half? What happens if I retire at 62? What happens if I retire at 65? That doesn't suggest you're going to retire at 59 and a half.
Okay. Thank you. Have a great day.
My pleasure.
Just real quick here, we had someone who was calling off the air that was interested in knowing, do you know of classes, investment classes, financial planning classes that are available at some of the community colleges in our area, in Danville, Champaign, Urbana? Whatever.
I think every community college, clearly Parkland has beginning classes on investments. And they are typically taught by investment advisors in the community. Sometimes there are permanent faculty, but by all means, that I think they're taught at each of the local community colleges.
All right. People just need to take a look at the catalogs, the class offerings, just to find out what those places are offering. All right. Well, let us talk next with someone in Mattoon, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question. You talked earlier about taxable accounts, non-taxable accounts, like monies in each of those.
Yes.
And where do you put the bond section of your portfolio then? What's preferred?
Well, I frankly prefer the bond section outside of the tax deferreds, because if you're buying bonds, are you buying individual bonds?
No, bond funds.
You're buying bond funds. Well, number one, I'm not very excited about bond funds. If you're going to be in bond funds, make sure that they are short bond funds, never more than an average maturity of 7 years. Okay? So I really am not very happy with bond funds that have a maturity of greater than 7 years. Too much volatility, not enough total return. And what happens is that the bond fund managers, when interest rates go up, they sell off the bonds. And bonds vary inversely in value with the direction of interest rates, which means when interest rates are going up, they sell off bonds. They're selling them at depressed prices and replacing them with new bonds, but that reduces the net asset value of the fund. And it really impacts your total return. So if you're going to hold bond funds or bonds, typically if they're short-term bond funds or bonds, there isn't a lot of tax impact on them. And I typically would hold those outside of a retirement account.
Okay. Sounds good, Dan. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we'll go to line number 1. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I just want to make a quick point about socially responsible investing or funds. I know a lot of times people are surprised what they see they invest in, and that's because they do what's called best of class screening.
Yes.
In each sector, they'll just invest in the top 50% of the companies that rank against their social and environmental criteria.
Against their criteria, right.
Yeah, so we're always kind of surprised what shows up in there once in a time, but that is because they do make the screen and they've inched away in the top 50%. And it is a mechanism to promote social change and environmental change. So there's a mechanism there working in these funds. And also I might note that Urbana Adult Ed has investment classes also.
Thank you for that tip. That's excellent.
Thank you. Right.
Very good. Okay, we'll finish up here, I think, with line three. Hello.
Hello. I had a question about diversification. I'll kind of limit it only to international stocks and funds. It seems to me that there are times when it's either safer to park some money in cash or to consider international investments. About a decade ago, if you had invested in Asia, it was pretty much a surrogate on NASDAQ. A lot of it was tied to technology. Today, with the importance of China and also India, it's a little less certain that that's the case. I guess what I'm trying to focus on are how you would develop a portfolio that would focus on international investments that would really be independent of the U.S. markets and would really operate quite differently. A lot of claims about diversification, especially if the interest rates are rising or things of this sort, will affect the market. Over the U.S. market overall, and one has to look overseas, perhaps, to find areas that will cope, you know, not travel along with the U.S. markets.
Well, that's right. If you look at your diversification, what really has to happen is you can't look at these indexes in a vacuum. You have to be in three or four of them because then they act as diversifiers. Certainly, if you're interested in China and India, that's considered emerging markets. That's the emerging markets index, and that's going to dominate the emerging markets index in the future. So that's something that you want to look at. Pacific Rim has certainly operated independently of the U.S. markets. It's actually underperformed, and now it is finally moving up, at least getting close to even to the U.S. market. So I'd look at the Pacific Rim, and in the Pacific Rim, especially the smaller companies, smaller cap value in the Pacific Rim and the emerging markets. Those are good diversifiers. They perform differently than U.S. markets.
All right, we got to leave it there with our thanks to guest David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here. We talk about money management. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. There were just a tremendous number of great questions today.